WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacy Lynn. Cheers erupted in Tel Aviv early this morning as Hamas released four Israeli hostages. CBS's Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Dozens of masked Hamas militants armed with assault rifles and wearing military fatigues handed four female Israeli hostages over to the Red Cross. The women soldiers who were captured on October 7th smiled and waved to a crowd of Palestinians in a central Gaza square. Families of the hostages watching on TV in Israel clapped and cheered.
President Trump is in Las Vegas today after visiting first North Carolina yesterday to survey hurricane damage and then Southern California to see the wildfire damage there. CBS's Bradley Blackburn reports he, along with the First Lady, toured a neighborhood destroyed by the Palisades fire.
He also met with firefighters and wrangled with the Los Angeles mayor over the recovery and rebuilding process for homeowners.
You mentioned hazardous waste. Well, the hazardous waste. What's hazardous waste? I mean, you're going to have to define that. We're going to go through a whole series of questions on determining what's hazardous.
I just think
you have to allow the people to go on their site and start the process tonight.
And we will.
And Bradley tells us the president is in good spirits after news about one of his controversial cabinet choices.
As he was leaving for Las Vegas late Friday, President Trump had just learned his pick for defense secretary was confirmed by the Senate.
We have a great secretary of defense. We're very happy about that.
Multiple sources confirming the Trump administration fired a bunch of federal inspectors general overnight. Mike Ware is the IG of the Small Business Administration and says he was among them. In a letter he wrote to a White House official and obtained by CBS News, he called the firings legally dubious. Federal law requires the White House to give Congress a full month of warnings and details before firing a federal inspector general. The move will likely result in legal challenges. So what are the safest airlines in the world?
Air New Zealand, Qantas, and Virgin Australia take the top three positions, followed by Gulf carriers like Etihad, Qatar, and Emirates. And which airlines have the lowest possible safety rating? Russian Airlines Aeroflot and Russia, as well as Pakistan International Airlines.
Peter Greenberg says, keep in mind, though, 4.4 billion people flew around the world safely last year, and only 318 people died. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Enjoying this local program?
Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. One in three kids living in rural areas of Wisconsin is insured by Medicaid, and Congress is considering cutting some of the program's funding. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
The nationwide study from Georgetown University's Center for Children and Families used census data to compare how many people living in rural areas are insured by Medicaid. William Park Sutherland with Kids Forward explains northern Wisconsin counties above Highway 29 have higher than average rates of children enrolled.
We really are leveraging our future by targeting a program that not only, but one of its most important roles is protecting the health of kids.
About 1.5 million Wisconsinites are insured through Badger Care, the state Medicaid program. It makes up about 26% of the state budget, providing health care coverage for low-income residents from birth to age 64.
There's just no way to cut out this much of the program, right? $2 trillion, and not hurt children, not hurt seniors, and not hurt people with disabilities who depend on Medicaid along with parents and caregivers.
He says cuts would also risk increasing the number of uninsured people, up the amount of medical debt and financial insecurity in the state, and potentially deter people from seeking care. Wisconsin is one of 10 states that has not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. A Wisconsin Policy Forum study shows the state could save $1.7 billion over the next 2 years if it did. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some flurries or light snow showers. We'll have highs in the mid-20s. It'll be windy, with winds gusting up to 30 out of the west. For tonight, partly cloudy and windy with a low around 6 degrees. Sunshine for Sunday with a high near 27, mid-30s Monday.
Currently 26 degrees.
Ooh, let's unplug from the politics and rock some local tunes on Max Inc. This week, we welcome Or Does It Explode and Chicago Blues Hall of Famer Paul Flipowitz. It's Max Inc. Saturday and Sunday, 6 p.m. across the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is 93.5 The Tap. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Solar Review. My name is Jim Santel. Welcome to this, the second hour of our discussion. Many things to undertake in terms of review and analysis, including this threshold issue of the kinds of things that are present inside our judicial system, our constitutional regime, that contemplates checks and balances, and indeed focusing a lot in our first hour on the role of U.S. attorneys, ensuring that the prosecutions, the investigations that precede those prosecutions are legitimate and premised upon a belief that there have been actual violations of federal law, not animated by inappropriate considerations like race or religion, gender identity, those kinds of things, or certainly not politics either. The role also that federal district court judges play in checking the executive, checking even grand jury indictments to ensure that they are legitimate, that they have not been the product of some inappropriate movement forward. And all of that standing in our system and talking in particular about the role of federal judges in ensuring that the executive branch, whether it's under the rubric of the Department of Justice or any other agency, even the West Wing, is abiding by the Constitution, and in particular noting this important example coming out of the news just this past week in which a federal district court judge, John Cowenauer, in Washington and Seattle, determined, as he said, that this is a blatantly unconstitutional order that Donald Trump has executed attempting to change the 14th Amendment of our Constitution. Judge Cowenauer, his emphatic decision could not be mistaken. He said, I've been on the bench for over four decades, he said. This is a blatantly unconstitutional order. Where were the lawyers when this decision was made, he said, during the course of the 25-minute hearing that he had in which he decisively said, can't do this, can't do this. Indeed, Judge Cowenauer was nominated to the bench by Ronald Reagan. Again, four decades ago, and it is his insight, it is his perspective, non-political, non-partisan. It is regrettable that we talk these days about who nominated you, who confirmed you, what kind of a Senate confirmed you, and whether you're a Republican or a Democratic federal district court judge. The reality is that they take an oath of office to be nonpartisan. And so we hope one day that we can drop those appellations that describe them in a way that suggests that they are partisan. I would offer that Judge Cowenauer this past week is exactly the kind of judge who we need on the bench. And that's the kind of person who, again, provides these checks and balances for, once again, U.S. attorneys and investigative agencies and, yes, grand juries and, yes, the conduct of the executive branch generally. And is there a check upon the judges themselves? The answer is yes. The answer is, of course, as we have already spoken, that they are themselves are subject to the advice and consent of the Senate. The Senate has from time to time rejected nominees of presidents based upon the notion that they do not believe that they are qualified to be in those positions. That, too, is a check on them. Plainly, the judges themselves have checks. The appellate process, the Supreme Court process, even decisions of the Supreme Court can effectively be overruled, if you will, by legislative fixes, for example, in the area of privacy rights and voting rights and many other things, if the Congress decides to do it. All kinds of things in place to ensure checks and balances. And that leads to our callers this weekend. Appreciate very much the contributions to this discussion about checks and balances. I'm going to begin with Mark, who's been in line for a while. Mark, you've got a comment about the legitimacy of this process by which we select federal judges, the importance, I believe, you're going to articulate of this notion that we get people who are competent, who are intelligent, who are bright, whose oath of office means something to them. Mark, glad to have you with me this weekend.
Marker.
Yes, Mark, go ahead.
I think the questions have kind of got a little mixed up. I think my first question is on the judicial hires that for the law lawyers are going to hire from top-rated colleges. I guess they've suspended that program, that and probably we'll be getting lawyers hired from unaccredited institutions to be Trump's new lawyers. But the other question I had, probably more pertinent, and maybe I'm being far-fetched here, but apparently there's members of the Supreme Court that were questioning the legitimacy, actually, of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments in the first place, maintaining that they weren't properly ratified in the first place because, after all, we forced the Confederacy to sign off on those as part of the conditions of rejoining the Union. And I wonder if that's an attitude they'll take in trying to uphold Trump's birthright citizenship ban. It's, well, the 14th Amendment really isn't legitimate in the first place because it was never properly ratified. I don't know if they'd go to that extreme, but with this group, I do not know.
We don't know, right? And it may well be, again, this order that is unassailable. This is a ridiculous notion. That's not a legal term. That's an observational term that, Mark, you and I and our listeners know well. We learned this in civics, if we've had those classes, and certainly in our general understanding of how government works. This is not a close question. It's unfortunate that our judiciary is taking time to address this plainly. Unfounded allegation, this unfounded premise that somehow the 14th Amendment should not be understood as its language plainly contemplates. But we know, Mark, as you have just said, that our Supreme Court has surprised us in the past, including invocations of history. We think about the guns cases. We think about Heller and Bruin looking back in time to find predicates to suggest that what we thought all along is wrong. Antonin Scalia back in the time that he reviewed that Heller case, establishing for the first time based upon history that didn't change, but nonetheless an different interpretation of it, provides now a completely different understanding of the Second Amendment since his time that we had in the long history of our nation until that time. We will see if this particular frivolous and unsupported notion makes its way beyond the district courts, the federal courts in our nation, ultimately the Supreme Court. We shouldn't be spending our time on this kind of thing. Mark, appreciate the comment generally about the legitimacy of judges and where they come from also, as whether it's judges, whether it's lawyers, all those folks, U.S. attorneys who are subject to the advice and consent of the Senate. The questions need to be asked. Are they qualified to serve as judges? Are they qualified to serve in these all-important decisions, making judgment calls based upon the law? That's the role of the United States Senate, and it's appropriate for the public also to weigh in on that process. Mark, thanks for your observation once again this morning. We also have other callers on the line. Ross, calling in. Appreciate your comment or question as a part of our broadcast this weekend.
Hey, good morning, Jim, and thanks for your show. It's just a nice insight into, if I call it an institution, this part of American legal system, which most of us are getting through TV shows or the old Judge Wapner kind of,
yes.
But you're trying to help us understand, and it seems big. I mean, it's a huge issue. But I have like two questions. One specific. regarding the pardons.
Yes.
Is whether or not these insurrectionists, convicted insurrectionists that have been pardoned, if their records are actually expunged, that is, if one of those guys applies for a job at my place,
right.
And I look up their record, am I going to see that? And then number two is just, it seems as if with the way the politics goes, all it can take is one president, Trump, who in the span of his first 4 years can put these members into the Supreme Court. It seems almost as if the law can sort of become, you know, we think of precedent, we think of like, well, this is the way we've always understood it. But I'm wondering if we're now, as I get older and I'm realizing the whole world is just being upended and the things that I thought were normal are no longer normal. I'm just wondering if we're watching or witnessing a legal system that where what we thought was precedent is now going to be sort of cast away in some sort of new kind of like, and I know I'm being a bit vague, but when you think of like abortion or you think of immigration, and who knows? I mean, anyway, I won't go on and on, but that was more of a general comment.
Yep.
But that first question is just about whether or not these guys' records are going to be totally expunged and
right.
In that respect. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Great, great questions. And indeed, Ross, that's the next subject on our broadcast this morning, pardons and their implications for those practical kinds of things. I also appreciate very much your second comment about the role of precedent and the notion that Americans should be able to rely again upon the language of their Constitution. They should be able to rely upon the established precedent of 50 years when it comes to privacy rights in this country, of other longstanding traditions, judicial traditions. For example, one that contemplates that federal judges defer to reason, defer to the experts inside agencies. That's Loper Bright Enterprises, which rescinded that concept. It's been out there for 40 years. And while I am sometimes accused of hyperbole, I will not accuse anyone, any caller, including you, Ross, of hyperbole. The reality is the question that you raise about the future and what are the implications when, in fact, the things we understood always to be the bedrocks of our community, of our nation, are no longer that. And again, the pardons themselves, as you identified, also give us pause to think about how that process, which has always in the past, and this is a good introduction into that discussion of pardons, have always in the past been an invocation by a president for mercy, M-E-R-C-Y. The notion has been the reason why pardons are completely unchecked in the Constitution, with some very, very limited possibilities of attack. The reason why they're unassailable is that the notion James Madison had this thought, you should have a president who looks at the past history, and this does get a little bit to your first question, what this person did, what their crime was, whether they are contrite, whether they've looked back and said, you know what, I regret doing that. I very much come before you, Mr. President, on my knees and begging for some forgiveness and for some sense of mercy. And I've also done something, by the way, in my life that makes sense in terms of making the community better, ensuring that the things that I have done in the past, not only a part of my past, I've taken responsibility for those. I get it. I understand that I can never do those things again, but I've also lived up to higher ideals beyond that. I've done something in my community that makes it better, stronger for my family, for my neighborhood, for my neighbors who are also in need. That's been the application of pardons in the past. And for that reason, getting a bit back to your question, Ross, about the pardon process in particular, there's a thing called the Office of the Pardon Attorney. And most applications until recently, both our recent presidents, have not followed that process completely. We'll talk more, Ross, about your particular question and about pardons in general when Amicus here, a law review, continues.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Up North News Radio. It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
This is Amicus Law Review, talking all about the rule of law in America. Much on our national attention, our national focus, discussions a lot about the processes of government in the wake of this tumultuous and in many ways dizzying week coming out of Washington, D.C. Appreciate very much the inquiry made by Ross just before this last break about pardons, because we're going to talk about the pardons issued by Donald Trump and also issued by Joe Biden before he departed. Ross had a particular question that prompted my reference to the Office of the Pardon Attorney. This is an entity inside the Department of Justice. It's not there in the Constitution. And yes, indeed, whether you are President Trump or President Biden, if you want to wake up in the morning and issue a pardon, you can do it without any process, without any review. But the normal process is that if you make an application, that goes to this thing called the Office of the Pardon Attorney. It's inside the Department of Justice. It's responsible to the Attorney General. And those people look at the merits of an application and they review things. For example, how long has it been? Traditionally, 5 years. 5 years after the conclusion of any particular conviction, a judgment. 5 years after the sentence has been served completely. And they also then look at the nature of the underlying conduct, and they look at the things that have happened since the time of the offense conduct, and they make a recommendation to the White House about whether a particular application should be granted or not. That's the normal process in America. Frankly, both Joe Biden and Donald Trump, presumably in recent days and even the past 10 days to several weeks, have not followed that process. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing illegal about it. But the process contemplates some regularity, and that's the reason why it is in place. And so it also prompted Ross to ask the question about the implications of a pardon and what happens when Joe Biden or Donald Trump issues a pardon. And the answer is just this. And again, there's a lot of language here, and I know that this may sound like a lawyer talking, because it is, but it's also the standards out there. A pardon does not erase a conviction. Plainly, it doesn't erase a conviction from history. We're going to talk in just a few moments from now about the words of federal district court judges who are affirming just that, that even though the pardons effectively dismiss cases, they do not erase things from history. They do not erase a conviction in the official records, but it can restore civil rights and remove some legal disabilities that are out there. Pardon, again, a form of forgiveness, an extension of mercy by the president, restoring civil rights, those kinds of things. It can relieve some of those long-standing legal disabilities. It does not remove, in response to Ross's question, a conviction from public view. And so if those folks come forward, they will say, you know what, I have been forgiven. My pardon effectively removes officially any of the impediments, should be, to all those other civil liberties out there. But it is still there as a part of the public view that can be accessed. It can also include sealing records related to the conviction in some states. And to remove a conviction
from a person's record. Then you have to go through the second process, which some of them have also done, called expungement from the court record. So it's a little bit deep. There's a lot going on there. But the answer is ultimately that expungement seals that person's record so that the conviction is no longer publicly accessible. Pardon in itself accomplishes a lot of things, but does not prevent public view of what happened here. We also have other callers on the line. Again, appreciate both Mark and Ross to this point, and also appreciate John, who's likewise been waiting for a long time to be a part of our discussion this weekend on Amicus. John, go ahead with your comment or your question.
This is Jack from Merrimack.
Yes, Jack, go ahead.
Okay, I have two comments and a question.
All right.
First comment is this is what you get when you put a criminal into the White House, is he will pardon other criminals. That's part of his duty. Second thing I want to say is apparently the Supreme Court of the United States has implemented what I'm going to call the Nixon Doctrine. I believe it was Nixon who said, if the president does it, illegal.
Right. A very famous interview, right, with David Frost, right? And all of us rejected that and said, no, he's wrong about that. Turns out, Jack, I suspect this is your comment, that the Supreme Court said, yeah, in terms of that Trump versus the United States case in July of this past year, they said, turns out Richard Nixon was right. Go ahead with your further exposition of that, please.
Okay, well, the question that I have then is this. So Trump has royal immunity. He can't be prosecuted for virtually anything he does, including inciting insurrection in office, by the way. But that's not what I'm going to go. I am going to ask this, though. He can order all this stuff done. For instance, he can order the unlawful arrest of American citizens who are either naturalized citizens and just, either don't have their papers on them, things like that. I believe stuff like that's already happened, by the way. But what about the people who are actually responsible, who are physically doing that? Can't they be prosecuted for illegal activities? That's the question.
Right.
If you order something illegal, can't those people be who do it, who implement it? Because he's got a whole bunch of lackeys and yes men around him. Can't those lackeys and yes men be prosecuted? Of course, he could probably give a pardon to them preemptively, too, but it still could cause them to at least have a little pause.
Right. Absolutely. And Jack, that is the question of the days and the hours here, right? In the wake of the Supreme Court's decision, as you accurately noted, not only establishing a hugely powerful executive branch, but also saying you're immune from prosecution. The case coming out of the Supreme Court on July 1 talks about the president himself or herself, does not talk about that all-important question about what happens when the president directs somebody else, including people in the Department of Justice, including an attorney general, including an assistant attorney general, including a United States attorney, to do something. Are they also protected by virtue of an umbrella or shield of this immunity? That hasn't been tested. And again, it goes back to this notion that I was articulating earlier in response to previous comments and questions and observations, which is this is the reason why you need to have people as U.S. attorneys, as an attorney general, as, frankly, supervisors, special agents in charge of the FBI. This is the reason why the director of the FBI and his subordinates. This is the reason why people are in charge of the ATF and DEA and other federal agencies in all of our districts nationwide need to be people of integrity who say that their ultimate obligation is not to a president. It is to the Constitution. It's to the people of the United States of America. And if indeed they're being asked to do something that they have concluded is not only violative of legislation, of laws, but of the Constitution, their oath compels them to say no. And that's the tension that we may, in fact, be seeing in the near future here, especially as the Department of Justice recently, again, issues a memorandum suggesting that people in state and local authorities could be prosecuted for exercising their sense of what is right and wrong in America. Jack, appreciate the comment very much. All of that going to be coming up in terms of assessments of the future of America. We'll do exactly the same thing as Amicus Law Review continues.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matt Nair on air.
CBS News Brief. Hamas has freed four female Israeli soldiers in exchange for 200 Palestinians in Israeli jails. Reporter Robert Berger is in Jerusalem.
The women soldiers who were captured on October 7th smiled and waved to a crowd of Palestinians in a central Gaza square.
Vice President Vance just swore in Pete Hegseth for defense secretary minutes ago. Here's CBS's Bradley Blackburn.
As he was leaving for Las Vegas late Friday, President Trump had just learned his pick for defense secretary was confirmed by the Senate.
We have a great secretary of defense. We're very happy about that.
CBS News confirms the Trump administration fired the independent inspectors general of at least a dozen federal agencies late Friday, likely triggering legal challenges. Stacey Lynn has more.
Federal law requires the White House to give Congress a full month of warning and case-specific details before firing a federal inspector general.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Marquette over Villanova. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball. Marquette glided to an 87-74 win over Villanova in Milwaukee last night. Chase Rose had 18. Cam Jones scoring 16 points. In the Big Ten, the Wisconsin Badgers hosting the Nebraska Cornhuskers tomorrow at noon. Wisconsin back from that tough 85-83 loss to UCLA. Greg Gard.
We'll go through the film here today and learn from it and quickly turn the page. You see every night in this league, it's very competitive. And you're going to have some really good times, and you can't get enamored with those, and you're going to take one on the chin here or there, and you can't get overwhelmed with that. They're upset. They know we didn't play up to our ability, specifically defensively, and you know, I think quite frankly, we feel we should be 7-1 right now in the league. We're not. I expect nothing less than them to bounce back and be ready to go today and tomorrow and prep for Nebraska Sunday.
That's the Badgers head coach Greg Gard with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some flurries or light snow showers. We'll have highs in the mid-20s. It'll be windy with winds gusting up to 30 out of the west. For tonight, partly cloudy and windy with a low around 6 degrees. Sunshine for Sunday with a high near 27, mid-30s Monday.
Currently 26 degrees.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We have updates on important state Supreme Court cases involving the outcome of a November 2024 North Carolina Supreme Court election and whether Pennsylvania can count mail ballots with missing dates. First to North Carolina, where after two recounts, a race for Supreme Court justice is separated by 734 votes, with 5.5 million ballots cast. Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs was declared the winner over Appeals Court Judge Jefferson Griffin, but Griffin refused to concede and appealed to invalidate as many as 60,000 voters. Griffin's challenge includes voters with felony convictions, despite North Carolina's returning citizen rights restoration. He and the North Carolina GOP also challenge voters with incomplete registration information, some of whom are even elected officials and have voted for years. Wednesday, the Carolina Journal reported that the North Carolina Supreme Court refused to hear the case in a 5-1 decision, sending it back to Wake County Superior Court to consider Judge Griffin's complaints. Back in October, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court refused to rule on whether on-time mail-in ballots missing a signing date could be counted. Of the two challenges filed, the ACLU's argument that rejecting the ballots is a violation of the state constitution's free and equal elections clause will be considered. No trial date has been set. We have more on both cases at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself. surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Dom Salvia.
Next time, our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kaye, will discuss the fallout from tribal and U.S. citizens getting caught up in the immigration sweeps. Also, which cabinet picks are in and out. Tune in.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. For these remaining minutes in our weekend broadcast about all things legal and rule of law, justice related, time necessarily talking about pardons in America. Once again, an issue that we have visited in past broadcasts. A couple of things, again, in the category of basic civics. We know well Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1 of the Constitution says this. President shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. An interesting condition there at the end of that. And that's all the Constitution says about pardons. It is an unfettered, unchecked authority of the presidency. And indeed, the United States Supreme Court, in some collateral view of issues related to that, have said just that in a case called Ex Parte Garland, not our present or our former U.S. Attorney General, back in 1866, said the power conferred is unlimited, with the exception of the impeachment aspect. The power of the president is not subject to legislative control. Congress can neither limit the effect of the pardon nor exclude from its exercise any class of offenders. The benign prerogative of mercy, once again, that mercy concept reposed in him cannot be fettered by any legislative restrictions. That's Ex Parte Garland. A couple of other things that are important to understand in addition to this unchecked authority of a President Biden, of a President Trump to issue these pardons is just this, that pardons, in fact, can be rejected. A case called Wilson, 1833, Supreme Court held that a pardon can be rejected by the intended recipient and must be affirmatively accepted by that recipient to be recognized by the courts. And indeed, you know well, there's at least one, if not more, of the so-called recipients of the pardon from Donald Trump who said, no, I do not accept it. I have done something wrong, and I do not want to be a part, one particular defendant said, of a cult. I have rejected what I did before. I recognize that what I did was wrong, but I don't want that pardon. I want my record to remain because of what I did and stand as a symbol, a deterrent to other people. Supreme Court says you can do just that. There's also a thing called commutation, which we also saw from Donald Trump just this past week. He commuted the sentences of many of the organizers, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the Enrique Terrios, the Stuart Rhodes of the world, reduced their sentences from these long, decades-long sentences to time served, and they were released. That's reducing the sentences. That's not issuing pardons, although he did some of that as well. And in that case, you cannot refuse a commutation of a sentence different from a pardon. And here's the other big point that I've also underscored implicit in those Supreme Court cases, and it comes from a case called Burdick, and says just this. Supreme Court telling us that the acceptance of a pardon is an imputation of guilt, an acceptance of a confession of it. In other words, you take a pardon, you accept a pardon, and you're acknowledging that you have done something wrong. That's Burdick versus United States in 1915. Circumstances, the court said, may be made to bring innocence under the penalties of law. If so brought, escape by confession of guilt implied in the acceptance of a pardon may be rejected. And that is an important notion, not only for what has happened here in terms of the Trump pardons, that is all of these 1,500, 1,600 people pardoned by Donald Trump, carrying along with it, even though much debate about appropriate debate about the propriety of releasing violent criminals back into our communities, also carrying with it the legal imprimatur of an acceptance of guilt for what they were convicted of. That's no small matter. And it also animates, of course, the preemptive
pardons that were issued by the prior president, Joe Biden. Much discussed, the prior pardons also carry with them a recognition that there's something wrong. And that's my principal argument, candidly, with the Biden preemptive pardons. That is that the people, good people, decent people, did nothing wrong. Nothing wrong at all. They did not commit crimes, unlike the Trump pardons. And yet the acceptance of those pardons was, yes, indeed, shields them from the investigations we talked about before, shields them from the prosecutions that Donald Trump has promised. And I get completely the concern about that, that legitimate people might be subject to investigative work, arguably prosecution work, if in fact the systems fail us. Even so, I am concerned profoundly that those pardons also carry with it admissions of guilt. Tony Fauci did nothing wrong. Tony Fauci was a public servant, and there's nothing about his background that was criminal in nature. Mark Milley, likewise, nothing wrong at all, served with great honor, did not commit a crime. The pardons that they and others accepted, including the pardons of the Biden family, carry with it the legal imprimatur of having done something wrong. And that's my concern for the present and also for the future here. What should have happened in all these cases is that attorneys, frankly, looking again to attorneys, should step up and say when those investigations happen under this present administration, attorneys agreeing to represent them, represent the targets of those investigations in those investigative pushbacks. That's what should happen. The lawyers of this country concerned about decency in the investigative process should step up and offer in a pro bono way to serve those people who are unlawfully, inappropriately, unconstitutionally targeted as opposed to pardons. And yet, once again, all those pardons now in place by virtue of the absolute unchecked capacity of a Joe Biden and of a Donald Trump to impose those pardons. And the other comment I make before we get back to some other callers is just this. The pardons by Donald Trump, wildly, wildly different from the pardons granted by Joe Biden. Joe Biden exercising mercy in every single one of those pardons recently, and yes, in the 1500 group, in the 2500 group, all of them consistent with the purposes that the Office of the Pardon Attorney probably put on the imprimatur on those pardons. He was acting consistent with the mercy contemplated by our founding fathers. Donald Trump, in granting these pardons to 1,500, 1,600 people, what did he do? What was his approach to all of this? Well, over 600 of them, violent criminals, we know. 600 people, of that, a great majority of them engaged in violent activities and violent conduct on January 6th of the highest element. And as we said earlier, the result of all of this in response to Ross's very good question is their privileges and immunities are now restored. And that includes those pardons carried with them, the right now to carry weapons. There's a federal law, as you well know, that says that if you're a convicted felon, you cannot carry a weapon in America. The pardons basically remove that restriction. And now these 1,500, 1,600 people, some of them the subject of commutations, many of them violent criminals, the subject of those pardons, now able to carry weapons as well. Let's get back to some of our callers calling into our broadcast. Dick from Madison, appreciate your being a part of our discussion this weekend.
Well, you answered one of my questions.
All right, very good.
Attorneys taking pro bono, because I feel this guy that was arrested or detained in Newark should not have to spend money out of pocket. Anyway, question is this. When did the Oklahoma bombing was, what, about 94?
Dick, you pitched out just a little bit. Can you repeat what you just said?
The Oklahoma bombing in 94, I believe it was. If we would have put on the books domestic terrorism laws, would he have been able to pardon them then? I mean, something that would really stick.
Right. Obviously, this is Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols way back then. And as you know, Timothy McVeigh, one of the folks who gets the death penalty. It is available in the federal system, as we know. It's not in violation of the Eighth Amendment. And Timothy McVeigh executed for that horrific event during the Clinton administration for what happened at the Murrah Federal Building there in Oklahoma City. Hundreds of people, including many children, killed at that time. The answer is, to your very good question, Dick, the pardon authority spreads to all federal offenses. All federal offenses. So if the United States Congress issues laws and executes, and the Department of Justice executes on those laws, if they are federal convictions, federal judgments, a president can pardon, can also commute sentences imposed under those. So the nature of the underlying offense conduct, the way that the Congress describes it, is less important than the fact that they're federal. And your question, though, Dick, raises a very good point, which is federal pardons, the federal pardons that the presidents, Biden and Trump, have recently issued, do not extend to state offenses. And maybe that's where you go, Dick, right? You go to the state legislatures, which can also and do impose here in Wisconsin, in every other state and territory in the United States, they also issue and they also legislate in the criminal area, and they say this is prohibited. And if you engage in this conduct, whether it is of a terrorist nature, whether it is a domestic violence, white collar offenses, federal offenses, I'm sorry, financial offenses, document cases, all kinds of things, states can also make crimes in violation of their laws. Donald Trump was convicted of one set of those kinds of things. He stands a convicted felon in the state of New York. And for that reason, a president unable to effect a federal pardon on someone in that condition. We'll continue with this. As we continue with our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review. And in that connection, we have Richard on the phone. And Richard, your comment and your question here.
Okay, if I'm wrong, correct me. But in the 1920s, when Al Capone was out on the streets, from what I understand, a group of private businessmen, individuals, funded a research on him? Is that possible? If it's so, in this case, of at least the participants in some of this stuff going on.
All right. Richard, I have to confess to you, I do not.
Take their licenses away?
Right, yeah. I do not, I'm not familiar with that particular history regarding Al Capone, plainly prosecuted again by the government and found guilty ultimately and went to jail for tax offenses, right?
And I understood that there was like 8 or 9 private business individuals that funded up the work.
I am not familiar with that history, but it's interesting to think about. Oh. Go ahead.
No, well, the public was getting so upset over it. And at the time, I think Delano Roosevelt said, why is he still on the street? You know, he's wandering around Chicago.
Sure. And there's no doubt that regardless of what may have been done privately, obviously the country plainly very concerned, both outside and inside government, about what was going on with Al Capone, those kinds of things. Government continues to focus on white collar offenses and those kinds of things, mob kinds of things, all kinds of federal statutes that prohibit the things that Al Capone was doing. Regardless of the history, that I'll trust you, Richard, in terms of your description of some private initiatives to investigate him, undeniably, the government itself was also investigating him. And there's no way in which the prosecution of him for tax offenses could have gone forward without, again, the IRS and U.S. attorneys, Department of Justice and others pursuing those internal government processes to address the Al Capone situation. But again, underscores the broader point, Richard, which is Americans should be focused upon what a Department of Justice does, both to ensure the safety and security of the community and also to ensure that the processes of the Department of Justice, access to a grand jury, all the other things we talked about with respect to courts, that none of that is used in an abusive way. All of that has got to be the product of an integrity-based system where you've got good U.S. attorneys in place who understand their roles. You've got good federal judges, good grand jurors, all of them a part of the system. When we come back, some final observations about pardons and the rule of law in America.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. On Monday, January 20th, Donald Trump returned to office, sworn in as the 47th president of the United States. Right out of the gate, he took a number of actions on his top issue, immigration. Perhaps the most troubling of these is one aiming to end birthright citizenship in America. An immigration attorney I talked to told me, "We're going to sit through a lot of BS over the course of the next weeks, months, and years, but this is the big one." My take? This action from the Trump administration is despicable, unconstitutional, and fundamentally anti-American. The day after the order was issued, Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call joined a coalition of 20 states challenging this action in court. This legal battle will be a tremendously important one for all of us to follow.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
This is Amicus Solar Review. Appreciate tremendously the wonderful comments, the insights, the questions asked by our callers always on our weekend broadcast. Invite you to this discussion. Thank you so much for those contributions. The several of you have called in. You can also text in, of course, and get my attention and Max's attention as well as we discuss these various issues. Plainly, we will not be getting to, in substance, to some of the other important events of this week, including things inside the Department of Justice having to do with this directive to investigate and prosecute state and locals who may be opposed to the president's immigration policies, the implications for the Civil Rights Division of shutdowns, no new cases, no new movement forward on consent decrees, and also some Supreme Court issues having to do with, again, the future of law enforcement in America, and even a money laundering offenses. All of those things we're going to talk about in greater detail. They'll remain current in our next broadcast, so stay tuned for those as well. In our remaining minutes of this broadcast, however, let us continue to discuss this notion of pardons in both categories, both the Biden pardons, which again I've described in terms of an invocation of mercy, raise some concerns about the precedent that is set when a president issues preemptive pardons. And I have a colleague out there who says he's looking at all this and seeing the death of the pardon authority under the Constitution. I may not go that far, but it raises concerns about the precedent set. As one president leaves office, are we at the end of every term now going to be issuing preemptive pardons for anyone who served in the prior administration? That is not in the interest of the rule of law. That is not in the interest of justice overall. And again, my recommendation for all of that, if there are those people who are inappropriately politically, based upon partisan views, identified and targeted by an inappropriate administration, by an inappropriate attorney general, by an inappropriate U.S. attorney who's violating their integrity, their oath of office. What has to happen in America? Attorneys have got to come forward and offer for people who do not have a lot of resources. When you work for the government, you're not going to make a lot of money. You're not going to become multimillionaires. Attorneys in our nation, including me, need to come forward and say, I will represent you in the course of those investigations to ensure that you get the proper authority, that there is pushback on those investigations when and if they are products of those partisan authorities. That's the remedy to this problem. And going back once again to my greater concern and my much stronger condemnation of the pardons issued by Donald Trump. Once again, these are people, just to be clear, who engaged in the worst kind of violence possible. I think the media is doing a wonderful job these days of identifying not only the particular individuals, the subject of these pardons, but the violent people who are a part of these pardons. 608 of them altogether charged with assaulting or impeding federal officers. Of that group, 174 charged with enhanced versions of the law for crimes involving deadly or dangerous weapons, inflicting bodily harm on the officer. Indeed, we know the stories of those events. The video remains chilling as much today as it did in the immediate aftermath of January 6th. The wiping slate clean for violent offenders who did what? Using batons and stun guns and flagpoles and tasers and baseball bats and 2x4s and bear spray and chemical spray to attack our law enforcement officers. Five of them died, Mr. President, and others injured. A horrific event in American history, and you have given them all pardons. You have forgiven through this process their horrific conduct. And the justification that you provided to that is they've been in jail for a long time, President Trump said. These people have been destroyed. The victims of January 6th have been destroyed beyond words. And the condemnation that I convey on this broadcast to the in response to these pardons cannot be overstated. This is not the reason why James Madison put the pardon authority in place in our Constitution. Plainly, not a product of the deliberative process that our Vice President J.D. Vance contemplated when he said these were reviewed on a case-by-case basis. And indeed, as did many members of Congress, said that the violent criminals, those people who were that 608 group, they will not be pardoned. Plainly, that did not happen. The process by which assessments of the legitimacy of these pardons never went through the Office of the Pardon Attorney, that we're clear on. And that also underscores the great concern that all Americans should have for the conduct of this president in undermining the rule of law in this very significant way. In that connection, this president also did something else this past week that we will close on in this segment of our broadcast, and that is he requested that the pending investigations against remaining targets and defendants of January 6th, that those also be dismissed. And a number of judges in the federal courts there in D.C., three in particular, District Judge Beryl Howell, District Judge Tanya Chutkan, and District Judge Colleen Collar-Catelli, all decided, yes, indeed, I will dismiss those cases upon leave of court, which is the standard by which the rule is invoked to get those cases dismissed. But they also said, I'm not granting you everything that Department of Justice is asking for. I'm not going to grant that these dismissals will be with prejudice, which means they can never be brought again. They're going to be dismissed without prejudice. And even more important than that concept, they also spoke about the implications of what they were doing. Here is Barack Howell saying, contrary, Mr. President, to what you said, no national injustice occurred here, just as no outcome determinative election fraud occurred in the 2020 presidential election. No process of national reconciliation, she said, can begin when poor losers whose preferred candidate loses an election are glorified for disrupting a constitutionally mandated proceeding in Congress and doing so with impunity. She goes on to talk about the dangerous specter of future lawless conduct by other poor losers and undermining the rule of law. Judge Tanya Chutkan, also presiding over these cases, what does she say? She says that Trump's mass pardons cannot whitewash the blood, the feces, and the terror that the mob left in its wake. It cannot repair, she said, the jagged breach in America's sacred tradition of peacefully transitioning power. In hundreds of cases like this, she said, judges in this district have administered justice without fear or favor. The historical record established by those proceedings must stand unmoved by political winds as a testament and as a warning. All of that coming out from federal judges, other checks and balances in America under our Constitution. Thank you for joining me for this edition of Amicus Law Review every single weekend here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Have a good weekend, everybody.
93.5 The Tap. Earl Ingram.
The dismantling of diversity, equity, and inclusion under Donald Trump has already begun. On the next show, we'll talk with Dr. Eva Martinez-Paulus about what DEI really is.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10.
I'm Dr. Jasmine Zapata, Chief Medical Officer for Community Health at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Every year in the U.S., about 21,000 lung cancer deaths are caused by radon, an odorless, tasteless, and colorless gas. One in 10 Wisconsin homes has high levels of radon. Does yours? Call 1-888-LOW-RADON or visit lowradon.org to learn more. Test. Fix. Save a life.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. You are listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Wendy Gillette. Four female Israeli soldiers are now free from Gaza. CBS's Remy Innocencio is in Tel Aviv.
These are four young female soldiers. They emerged from that Hamas car and walked across Gaza City's biggest square. That's Palestine Square. They were smiling, they were waving, and at least appearing physically well. Then they were handed over to the Red Cross. Their names, 19-year-old Liri Elbag, 20-year-olds Karina Ariev, Daniela Gilboa, and Nama Levy.
The soldiers were freed in exchange for 200 Palestinian prisoners. In the West Bank, there were chants and celebration as buses transporting the prisoners arrived. Vice President Vance swore in Pete Hegseth for defense secretary within the hour.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.